part four of this very large series on Canuck as a Slur, a podcast about cool, cursed, and curious Canadian culture and history. With me still somehow, just trapped in the hold of this horribly renovated pleasure yacht, is Tanner from Beyond the Breakers, a podcast about shipwrecks, loss, maritime disasters, and lessons learned at sea. And I put it to you that despite only being three quarters through this story, we've already experienced all of those things.
We have. And, you know, that does remind me, since we talk about shipwrecks, you talking about a horribly renovated pleasure yacht. I know that came up earlier in this episode. We actually did an episode about a horribly renovated pleasure yacht called the Holo Holo in Hawaii. So definitely, it's one of my favorite episodes of the show that we have done. That comes recommended directly from me. So if you're going to check out the show, check out our episode on the Holo Holo.
I feel like I've listened to it. Now I can't remember.
It's an older one. It's probably in, I don't know, like the 70s or 80s, maybe, in terms of number.
I was like, did you record it in the 70s or 80s?
Oh, yeah. We've been in this game for a long time.
Whether it's the guy on the turtle or whether it's Maxwell, it's like, who invented the time bomb? They get no credit. Like, you get no credit for inventing podcasts in the 70s.
I wasn't far off with my guess. MV Holo Holo is episode 69 of the podcast.
No, well, that's very inauspicious.
Mm-hmm.
So we are now at the conclusion of our story. And we've been talking about many, many months long voyages, just interminable slogs across the sea. And probably not a feeling you can relate to right now, sitting this far into the recording.
I would be like, if this was a voyage, I'd be like, God, I hope someone has packed a massive bomb in the cargo hold that would just blow me out of here right now.
God, either that or a play where a black woman sues a Jew for a breach of promise. Either thing, I just need something to happen.
I'm just imagining that pitch like today. It's like idea for show. It's like, all right, so a black woman's going to sue a Jew. It's like, oh, stop you right there. Maybe not.
But you can have the twist on it that was, you know, promised there, where it's like, oh, no, don't worry. It's about skewering the wealthy saloon passengers. Like, sure it was, man. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But in our actual story here, where we left off, William King Thomas, he had a plan. The plan seems very simple, to use essentially the world's first ever clockwork timed dynamite explosive to sink a ship and collect the insurance money, right? Foolproof plan, other than the repeated times he's already failed at it.
It is amazing that someone has tried to bomb a ship so many times and just, like, can't do it and keeps getting more chances.
I mean, like, in fairness, the one time it's like, people are like, wow, this person has made an expert clock and it failed. Like, this is new technology. It's not, like, you can describe the mechanism you want. Turns out actually getting it to work is difficult. I think there were some places went over technically where it's like, this might have been more of the issue with the gunpowder ones, but like if you tip it over, suddenly it's like, if your thing is no longer like sitting with gunpowder against your striking mechanism, like, yeah, I think it's one of the problems of solved with dynamite, but it's like, you know, there's so many ways for things not to work.
And it's harder to tell people like, oh, you cannot open this to inspect it, nor can you turn it upside down. So people start to get more suspicious when you do that.
Yeah. We have come to December 11th, 1875, and William King Thomas is calmly riding a train to the harbor in Bremerhaven, telling other worried passengers about how safe oceanic travel really is. He gets in line to board, surveying his target, and it's an exciting scene all around. Here's the picture painted by the book.
He saw dock workers and sailors bustling about, making last preparations, yelling out gruff commands. Many travelers had gone on board and felt relieved by the splendid size of the ship, the warm welcome from the ship's staff, and the order and punctuality with which their effects were taken and stowed. A throng of passengers and their loved ones still congregated on the south side of the quay, opposite the lighthouse. Unwilling to say their last goodbyes until the final bell, they huddled in the sun to stay warm, clutching their shawls tighter around them.
So once on board, Thomas stows his luggage and comes back out on the deck, back to his observation of all the shipboarding activity. And that's when a police officer taps him on the shoulder. Nice little suspense point. I'm building the suspense by opening the last drink I grabbed. I really feel like I could have, this is a missed opportunity. I like to do location-based drinks. It's like, I could have had, like, there's probably, like, a St. Louis drink. There's probably, like, a nice Bremer drink, but I was like...
Well, I guess Budweiser would be a good St. Louis drink.
Yeah, and there's a connection to Germany. It all would have fit if I wasn't a hack and a fraud, but instead I'm just... We haven't even been in Nova Scotia for, like, three parts, and, you know, all I've got is all I've got is my keys. It's not bad, though. It's like, I haven't had it in forever. It's funny. I don't know if, like, you know much about the craft brewing stuff, but, like, I think this one was my first introduction to the term India Pale Ale. I don't know if you can read it on there.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, I don't like pale ales. I don't like the hoppy. I don't like the bitterness. But this doesn't taste like one. And I, if I remember correctly, there, at some point, like, with the craft brewing boom, there was this, like, bunch of people who decided, like, okay, we have to set a standard for, like, what defines a pale ale, what defines this. Mm-hmm. And what the definition they came up with, I don't know if it's based on, like, actual quantity of hops or just the IBU measurement, but this does not meet the definition for a pale ale. I don't know what that makes it.
Hmm.
It's, like, a different kind of ale because it doesn't taste, it tastes like every other, like, thing you find on the shelf that's, like, at every, like, focused liquor store. But yeah, it's like, it's, it still says it on the label, even though, like, technically everyone agreed, like, it's not a real pale ale.
It doesn't have to be labeled like IPA product, kind of like how craft singles are labeled like a cheese product rather than cheese.
I'm sure you just get grandfathered in. It's like, well, you know, you've been doing this a while.
IPAs, I never really liked them. I'm one of the IPA haters, but it's also, like, one of the only types of beers I could identify by taste. So, like, I'm not a huge beer guy. I couldn't say, like, oh, this is a lager or this is a pilsner or something.
All I know is that IPAs are defined by hops. And even this, it just says contains barley. That's all it says on it. I don't know. This is not a brewing podcast. I was just trying to create suspense for the cop who has metaphorically tapped him on the shoulder. The officer demands his papers. His response, do I look anything like a criminal? The answer was evidently yes, because he's forced to go and get his passport. He shows it to the cop. Cop looks at it and lets him go. No concerns.
All right.
Thomas is off the hook just in time for the ship's bell to toll the final call for boarding as the dock workers are attempting to load his precious cargo with their winch. And that's when William King Thomas's big heavy barrel of caviar slipped off the winch, fell to the dock, and exploded on impact, killing 81 people and wounding countless others.
Oh, no! I noticed that when you were saying it, you said attempting to load. I was like, oh, something's going to happen here.
And that's the end of part four.
Oh!
No.
81. Wow.
I have a note here, because I was surprised that it was hard to find the actual number of wounded. So... yeah, there's other sources I should note have suggested. It's possible it was actually like other cargo that landed on top of the barrel, sending it off, which is a big difference from it fell from a winch. But also anyone who is like close enough and paying attention to what happened, vaporized.
Right.
Ugh. So one way or another, during the loading, the bomb explodes. So, oh yeah, like she has a very prosaic way of describing in the book, which she says there's 135 orphans, 45 widows, and 20 hopelessly maimed victims. So you've got at least 20 maimed and killing 81, but like a lot of, and I mean, injuries is anything from like, you know, like, I mean, if you get a concussion from this, you're injured.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Thomas, of course, was spared. He and the police officer were still below decks in his quarters, thrown to the floor by the concussion of the blast. They rushed back up as soon as they could, gazing out upon the following tableau as described by an eyewitness.
A monstrous field of corpses spread out before us. The misery and moans of horrifically dismembered reached our ears. Burning scraps of clothing covered their amputated limbs. With tear-filled eyes, we turned away. The misery was too great. The knowledge of having been spared such a terrible death increased our feverish agitation. Everyone rushed to the gangway. It had disappeared.
Remember when he was doing like pork scams?
The halcyon days, back when pork scams were all we were doing, and now here's what it's gotten you.
Do you remember at the beginning when we were talking about bleak stuff and you're like, well, it'll get better?
Yeah, I do remember that. I remember what we were talking about, and it's a horse apiece, maybe. I mean, 80 dead is a lot of people. 81.
It is, yeah. This naturally meant that there was no fleeing the scene for Thomas, even if he'd wanted to. Unhurt or lightly injured bystanders rushed in to provide assistance. Our protagonist, ever the one with his priorities in order, rushed to the deafened captain because the captain was on deck and like was just like, at least like temporary, like explosion deafened, like ears ringing. He rushes the captain to say, hey, I need to send an urgent telegram.
I know you're busy. I know you're busy right now, but I need to do this.
Yeah, the captain's like, what? I've been blinded by an explosion.
You're going to have to talk louder, son.
And so, yeah, he gets dismissed. And so he's unable to do that. So William King Thomas instead goes back to his quarters once more, pulled out his revolver and shot himself twice in the head.
Ooh.
Twice.
That's pretty skillful, I guess. I don't.
Yeah, I mean, it's those weird old soft bullets, I guess. Or the gun just goes off twice. I don't know. Chronologically, this is pretty much where the story reaches its conclusion, or at least its climax. But there's a curious structure to the book, one that was evident as I seemed to be moving through the story much faster than I was moving through the page count. To give you a sense of it, The Dynamite Fiend is a 237-page book. The moment where the subject shoots himself takes place on page 148. Even accounting for the 30-odd pages of citations and notes, there's still an entire quarter of the narrative just to deal with the aftermath and address how exactly we know all the details we've got into. For starters, Thomas left behind very little to go on at the scene. He left two suicide notes. The first was for the Moselle's captain, and if you're looking, you can actually see it here, asking him to send the remaining money in his pocket to his wife at their home address in Dresden. It says, as he's written it, 20 British pounds and 80 German marks. Not a huge amount, but not nothing. He ended it with, "What I have seen today, I cannot stand," and signed it W.K. Thomas. The second note was for Cecilia herself, written as Mrs. C.F. Thomas, quote, "God bless you and my darling children. You will never see my to speak to again, William." And that is his own spelling mistake. Fucking idiot. Typo in your suicide note. You fucked that one up.
Yep, people are gonna, yep, this is what people are gonna remember you by.
Everyone in the group chat is clowning on your suicide note. Not only did he mess up his suicide note, he also messed up his suicide.
Oh.
He did not die. Or at least he did not die for 5 days, and in the meantime, he was taken to an ersatz infirmary along with many of his victims. One of the bullets had paralyzed his left side due to where it had traveled through and stopped in the right side of his brain. It was all he could do to lay there as nurses and doctors tended to him, and this provided local police an opportunity to interrogate him where he lay. William King Thomas, being who he was, he lied his ass off.
We can't stop now. I mean,
he's just about to get away with it.
I'm thinking of a novel like a, I don't even really know what postmodern literature really means, but I'd say it's like a, something like that, where it's this very cerebral, drawn out book. And I can imagine it happening like this situation. It's Thomas, you know, he's motionless for these 5 days and he's in a bed right next to a guy who's like, I don't know, burned over most of his body. He can't move either. But all that guy knows is that this is the guy who blew him up. And so over those 5 days, it's just the conversations and what they talk about and how they explore each other's psyche over this time with the man who almost was killed by this and the killer himself, who is expiring from two self-inflicted gunshot wounds. I can imagine that being a story that someone would write and probably someone would read.
I wouldn't put it past this author, but there's actually like, it's quite interesting how this all gets pieced together after. But yeah, as far as what constitutes postmodern literature, I would like to say this podcast script is postmodern literature. It's got, I don't know, narrative devices. There was some foreshadowing and you guessed some things.
Also, I,
Chekhov's barrel of dynamite.
Shout out to the Moselle. We have an episode on the Moselle, not this one.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a different one, right?
Yes, it is. It is a steamboat that explodes just off of Cincinnati. So a lot of mangled corpses in that one as well, though. So there is.
Is that the one where the people get like blown, like they're on the river?
Yes.
And they get blown like up to the other state or whatever?
Yeah, they get blown from Ohio into Kentucky, some of them.
Yes, I remember that one.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, light his ass off. His initial explanation for the suicide attempt was that he was bankrupt and too ashamed to face the consequences to himself and his family, which technically isn't exactly untrue. In fact, the answers he gave to investigators over the course of 5 days was a complete hodgepodge of truths and lies about his life, his family, and his criminal operations. Larrabee breaks down quite a few of those statements as true or false, Of some importance is that he does admit to being the handler of the barrel, although he repeatedly changed his story about it, even attempting to claim at times that it really was just polishing paste. My explosive polishing paste that just killed 80 people.
What I'm happy about, at least with the story, is that seems like he's going out the way he would have wanted, doing what he loved, just lying his ass off.
Yeah, that's right. He definitely died doing what he loved. I think that's fair to say, yeah. He did, of course, try to claim that his contacts in New York, particularly the man who shipped the barrel back to him, had used him as a patsy. Mm. Thomas Shirley understood he was dying. The investigators even told him so. It's kind of this is your last chance to come clean. Like, come on. His lack of contrition or remorse at this stage is particularly galling, especially considering his surroundings. Large swaths of entire families had been killed or wounded, and he was right in the midst of all of them. There's a minor printing hiccup that doesn't attribute this next excerpt in the text, but based on the citation in the index, it appears to be from a contemporary German magazine named Die Gartenlaube, which in my attempt to learn how to pronounce, I discovered had a pretty bad problem with anti-Semitism in its era.
Ooh.
Yeah. A German magazine in 1875?
It's funny to imagine like a German magazine in 1875 that's like noted particularly for its anti-Semitism. It's like that's probably some vile stuff.
I don't know if it was particular to the magazine. It was just that this is the magazine I looked up and they were like, by the way, they had a little bit of a bad run. So here is the account from that magazine.
It was a sad, heartrending business to identify the horrifically disfigured and dismembered corpses. It was a torn remnant of clothing, a briefcase, a ring, or some other sign that gave the relatives the painful certainty of their loss. Moving scenes of nameless pain repeated themselves at the hospital. A mother found, instead of her anxiously sought daughter, only her fur muff still containing her hands. A father had the head of his son brought into the house. One passenger sought for a long time the remnants of his father, but all he found was a blown-off hand, which he identified by the ring. That was all he could bring back to his grieving family.
Wow, it's just so much sadder and hits so much harder in the original German.
That was the voice of Mr. Heinz Schneckelberger himself.
I'm glad we finally got in some German. We didn't get any good Scottish, even though there were some people from Scottish. You know, it's like, William King Thomas, the pride of Nova Scotia.
Lady. Oh, aye. Yeah. That's my Scottish. That's all I can do.
Oh, yeah. 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 I mean, I didn't. Yeah. It's probably for the best.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, that's one I'm happy skipping that one.
And speaking of skipping things over, there's a lot said in the book about the various deaths and mutilations, more so than we've already done. But I'm not going to repeat all of it. But to give you an idea, at one point, the need to dredge the harbor for various body parts is mentioned.
Ooh, so many bodies that it's like interfering with harbor business. Like,
yeah, this just came up for me yesterday. We got called for a house fire for like medical standby. Thankfully, no one in the house. Mm-hmm. But as I was talking about it with this partner who's done more of it than me, I haven't seen a lot of like the burn stuff. But she was like, one of the worst parts if you have to deal with people that have like severe burns is like burning flesh is the worst smell. Mm. And like, it just never leaves you. It's impossible to get off you. Like, it's horrible. Mm-hmm. You also have clearly this going on when you blow people with dynamite too. Like, mm-hmm. It's going to just be like the nastiest smell as well. Mm-hmm. While the havoc wrought by the dockside detonation was horrendously grisly, we still shouldn't forget that had Thomas succeeded, the tragedy would have been at a much greater scale. The only numbers I could find on the ship's capacity come from a 2006 German language article in Der Spiegel, and I'm a little skeptical of their research since they claim at one point that Thomas was an American born in Halifax, Pennsylvania, which is wrong on multiple levels. Mm. There is a Halifax, Pennsylvania, but he's not from there.
Right.
And in fairness, they barely would have had this book to go off of by then. Mm-hmm. Regardless, they give the crew complement of the Moselle as 107, with 576 paying travelers booked on that fateful day, although it had a capacity of 900 passengers overall. Assuming these numbers are reasonably accurate, this means that a death toll of something like 683 was only narrowly averted, and that the man who became known as the Dynamite Fiend was more than prepared to kill hundreds, potentially even 1,000 people, to score as little as 28,000 of today's US dollars.
I think also with those, I'm assuming in those numbers, if you're looking at the paying passengers, I'm assuming that probably does not include young children who wouldn't have been separately ticketed. So it's like potentially a lot higher even.
Yeah.
Yeah. For what do you say? $28,000?
Yeah. Like 20. If that depiction of how he had insured the last one is correct, he would have gotten a payout of like 28,000 contemporary US dollars.
Oof.
Not a great haul.
Yeah. I mean, like, what is that? What is that per person that you'd be getting here? I'll just do divide by what's, I'll say 600. If it's
how many, what is it? PS5s per person, or
you're getting about $46 per person.
$46 per person.
Would you kill a person for $46?
That's like one case of fancy beer or one large case of beer.
You can buy a PlayStation game. Maybe with that.
Yeah, you buy a bunch of game. You could buy a good amount of like Alexander Keys, but not a great amount of like the fancy German beers. The German beers,
yeah,
you know, much more expensive. Going back to his interrogation, a lot happens over 5 days. At one point, he confesses his real name to be William King Thompson, not Thomas, as he appeared to be officially named. On the fourth day, Thomas attempted to rip the bandages off his head, presumably in some kind of attempt to bleed out and finally die, forcing the doctors to restrain him. In this space of time, the police also have time to track down Cecilia and urge her to visit her husband, who they only explain has attempted suicide. Word had reached her of the great tragedy in Bremerhaven, although the cause was not yet publicly clear, and it would have seemed far more likely that he'd been a victim, if anything. But once they arrived in town, she was taken to a hotel where the gravity of William's crimes was revealed to her. And now the police had a lot of questions, particularly as to how she could have really not known about any of his activities. She doesn't give up much and does come around to the wisdom of don't talk to the cops without your lawyer, or in her case, her friend, the American consul. She at least gets enough out of the police to be allowed to try and see her still breathing husband. She writes a very loving and conciliatory letter to him for them to read to him, hoping he'll ask to see her. They read it, and he's not interested. But since he's declared to be absolutely dying, they usher her in to see him anyway. And he's in such a poor state that she begs them to kill him. After a dramatic scene, she's ushered away, and he finally dies soon after. So this next picture in the book is labeled as the death's head. And I don't know if that means the head, like this is his dead body, or this is like the death mask that gets made. Because there is mentioned that in like the chapter, it's mentioned like some guy comes in and makes like a death mask, which is, I think, a bit of a thing. So I'm not sure. Either way, this is the death picture.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I was like, well, you wouldn't.
That is a dead guy.
I think that's the real guy, because you wouldn't put the mask on like a
well. Also, I guess
outfit.
I guess it's just kind of a dated way to refer to, but like the death's head. I guess using death as like a countable noun, the way that we would say like 8 deaths in accident.
No. The death apostrophe s head.
Right. That's what I mean. Like the head of the death. The death being the dead person.
Right.
So,
but dated like she wrote this book in 2002, and that's how she labeled it.
Yeah, that's weird. That's weird.
It's very weird. But, I mean, whether it's the replica or the real thing, that's how he looked like it when he died.
Yep, he looks real dead.
So this leaves everyone with a lot of questions. Cecilia never gives up her maiden name, and when the police sees all the correspondence at their residence, there appears to be a lot missing, particularly correspondence with family members that might imply more about either her or William's identity back across the pond. Because remember, they're only known as this couple that lives in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really have any connection to who they were before. They don't know who she was before, because she's just Cecilia Thomas. So remember, at this point, no one has a clear idea of who these people are. There's a lot of speculation, and it's aided in part by how it appears as though it was a lot easier to be sort of vaguely international at this point in time. Just to recap, William was born in Scotland, but moved to the colony as a young boy. And while it was already understood to be Canada, not only was it not formally confederated yet, it hadn't developed anywhere near the same distinct identity that the independent United States had. Things are also muddied by his distinct attempts to present himself as American and a Southerner specifically. Over the course of the book, this ends up all over the map. When he and Cecilia first arrive in Germany, Larrabee describes, quote, their plausible disguises as a wealthy Southern gentleman married to a genteel, educated lady from New Orleans. For one thing, Cecilia was actually from St. Louis, but more importantly, to an extent, this idea of the Southern gentleman implies some understanding among Europeans of Southerners as a distinct group from other Americans. At the time, a Pennsylvania-based abolitionist named Jane Swisshelm wrote that, quote, the aroma of huge estates and great expectations, as well as of past magnificence, attached to Southerners, end quote, in the eyes of the European aristocracy. At the same time, the first clockmaker Thomas visited spoke of him having, quote, the clear color of the Yankee dialect, end quote. Back when he was learning German, Swiss German, in Highland, Illinois, he told his teacher he was a New Yorker who'd run off to Canada as a young man. When he's crossing the Atlantic on the Celtic and performing in impromptu plays, Larrabee writes, we've already talked about this, some guessed from his slight accent he was a German of high class, others thought from his pleasant manners he must be an Englishman or American. When he's waiting to board the Moselle, just before the explosion, he makes a new acquaintance, described as a merchant of human hair who is transporting 126 pounds of yellow hair. And this person, it's only interesting because this person asks him, excuse me, but are you not from Milwaukee? Milwaukee mentioned. Thomas replied that yes, he was American, but not from Milwaukee. And finally, during his deathbed interrogation, one of the lies he told was that he was the son of German immigrants born in Brooklyn, but raised in Virginia.
He's just ticking all the boxes here.
Yeah. So I'm like, I'm curious how much you can just change your story around and everyone will believe it based on your accent, or how much he's changing his accent around to fit the story.
Yeah.
But none of that information was available to anyone at the time of the incident. So unsurprisingly, the various presses of the world described him as they saw fit. And this was, naturally, a fertile breeding ground for that classic 19th century bespoke xenophobia we all know and love. Jane Swisshelm, the abolitionist writer I mentioned a minute ago, chalked up Thomas's violent greed to his Scottish ancestry. But I had him Nova Scotia. Well, no, that's Pride of Scotland, actually. They're actual Scotland. But simultaneously, many in German society considered his actions to be emblematic of the American moral character. On the other side of the divide, we have writers like George Alfred Townsend, who, for context, has been accused of playing up the connections linking Thomas and his peers to John Wilkes Booth, blaming the notorious incident on, quote, the imperial scheme of creating a slave republic, an experiment abetted by England, whose colonial subject he was. For visuals here, we also have this is a postcard from Germany. It shows like the living 1875 and the dead 1875 images of him. It's kind of also a weird like Burning of Atlanta thing where it's like, yeah, here's a postcard. It commemorates a dude who blew up a bunch of people.
Well, also it's like by showing the living picture and the dead picture, this looks almost to me more like commemorative rather than like, hey, this guy sucks. Like this looks like something you would post of like a hero, not Thomas der Mörder.
Yeah. And there's no way to know what der Mörder means. But
it's like a few years ago, there was that headline in Der Spiegel where it was like, ist Trump ein Sexmonster? It's like, yeah. I don't speak German. Can someone translate this for me?
Hitler dode, wat nu? Like this, I think also kind of intersects with what we talked about. So in our first episode of Connect as a Slur, when we're talking about the greatest Canadian and how Alexander Graham Bell made the top 10, whereas like he was born in Scotland, he moved to Canada, did a bunch of work in the US and like summered in, I think it was also Nova Scotia mentioned. It was, so Alexander Graham Bell, he was in the top 10 greatest Canadians. He was also in like the 100 Great Britain's poll. Mm-hmm. And probably if you made a similar poll of like Americans at the time, you might've seen Alexander Graham Bell in like the greatest Americans. Mm-hmm. And it kind of brings you to why like, well, like nationalism's kind of stupid. And like a lot of people do live in a lot of places. They're not really tied to one thing.
Right. Here in this episode, we're learning lessons about what does it mean to be human, not Canadian or Scottish or American, but part of the human race, I think.
I think so. And that's my excuse of why this fits under a Canadian culture show. It's because it's like, well, at what point does he stop being, I don't know, do we have to claim him?
Mm-hmm.
But while the writers were writing, the investigators were investigating. And this is about as pro-cop as you'll ever catch me talking. The first break in the story comes during Cecilia's interrogation, where she does slip up in one instance. She accidentally uses the wrong name to refer to her husband. And this was blood in the water for the people trying to get to the truth. Barely a month after the tragedy, the widow and her four children sailed to New York under the assumed name of Thorpe. A reporter from the New York Herald tracked her down and got her to agree to a single interview, which turned out to be largely truthful and filled in many of the key details, especially with regards to how she'd originally met her husband back there in the United States. There are two elements of the interview that our author identifies as untruthful. For one, she tries to impress upon the public that she is without means and has made the crossing by the grace of a wealthy benefactor friend. Once again, it's like, I'm just a little guy. I got no money.
I'm just a little baby.
It's my birthday. But doubt is cast on this by court documents from the next year in which she sues a local for stealing clothing and jewelry from her, including a single item worth $1,500 at the time. I have no pockets. I just have all of, or I have no money in my pockets. Just all of these jewels, all of these furs, not a single scrap of food to my name. And it's an interesting look into her character too, of like, you know, she's a little bit of a scammer herself, clearly.
Mm-hmm. I like the idea of like, I'm broke, but like, I'm broke because everyone stole my diamond jewelry.
She claims she's broke a year before.
Before she files.
Yeah, before she has anything happen to her. Further damning to her cause is that she claimed that, as far as she knew, her husband had always been William as far as she knew, but in reality, that's not what her marriage certificate said. Whatever Cecilia's culpability and all of it actually was, she still appears to have done what her husband could not manage, walk off into the sunset. After the aforementioned court proceeding, Cecilia, last name Thompson, according to both her and the marriage license, disappears from the public record forever. What exactly happened to her from 1876 onward, we'll surely never know. I mean, she might have, like, died, but she might have just retired. Like, there's no way to know.
Yeah, I mean, good for you, girl.
Yeah. Well, I mean, she's not that old. She's got a whole life ahead of her still.
I want to point out also in this this German postcard picture,
yeah,
where it shows him dead on the right, just because of the way that the picture's printed, it's just, like, white, you know, face and black background. It looks like he's wearing like an Elizabethan like ruff around his neck.
Yeah.
Like the white. It's beautiful. It's very, very classy.
I think it is the same picture we looked at for the death's head. Yeah. Like it just looks clearer in this version.
Yeah. Yeah.
So with Cecilia out of the picture, that leaves the obvious elephant in the room, one we've repeatedly danced around. The aliases. This is exactly what puzzled the German police, who had to deal with a ton of false leads as they tried to piece it all together. They overturned every European stone they could, up to and including interrogating Alfred Nobel himself. Limited in their... Also, wouldn't you hate to invent something and then people are just harassing you for like, did you blow up the boat? Do you know who blew up the boat? It's like, no, man.
I don't know. I have no idea.
I'm a man of science. Limited in their scope when it comes to matters in the New World, they could hardly turn to the U.S. government, which at this time had a seriously limited investigative capacity. But you know what virtuous, unproblematic kings did have such meaningful capabilities in 1875?
Is it Wilhelm I?
No, in the U.S. Who's going to investigate?
I see. Wait, in the U.S. in the 1870s, is it the Pinkertons?
It is the Pinkerton Defective Agency. That's right.
Oh, yeah. Those guys.
The Pinkertons actually do great work here. Like, the Pinkertons are why we know this.
Boo! Boo!
Also, this is like pre-union busting Pinkertons.
Okay.
Yeah, all right. So, as if we hadn't had enough shipwrecks already, their founder, Alan Pinkerton, was also born in Scotland. Pride of Scotland. And emigrated as a young man, intending to settle in Canada as well. However, the experience of his ship running aground and being raided by a bunch of nasty Nova Scotians resulted in him choosing to settle in Chicago instead. Fair enough.
All right.
Despite his famed work in military intelligence for the Union side of the Civil War, he was unfamiliar with William King Thomas. Advanced in years, he delegated much of the investigation to his sons. Going on scant few leads, half of them wrong, his New York son-based Bob... And he is the strike breaky of the two sons.
Okay.
So I believe his other son is William Pinkerton. And like, he's based in Chicago and he is like way more into the detective work.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob is the one who's going and like
cracking skulls.
Yeah, exactly.
I wonder if Alan was doing like a one of those immoral psychological experiments where he raised one son to be into detective stuff and raised the other one to be into just like breaking people's kneecaps, just to see which one turned out to be the better Pinkerton.
Yeah, pretty much. But I mean, at the end of the day, they're also both cops.
Right. And the first A in ACAB is
Alan Pinkerton.
Alan Pinkerton.
Yeah, his New York son. New York.
In New York,
Bob
son.
Bob Pinkerton.
Love my Bob son. Pinkerton. Love my son. Love New York.
Love
New
my
York.
Son. Hate unions.
Love
the
Mets.
Mets. So Bob Pinkerton was frustrated by a lot of dead ends. But the rumor mill was churning throughout the United States, with the denizens of many cities becoming convinced that one of theirs had been the dynamite fiend. Because, like, the explosion makes international headlines.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big deal. It's like somebody blew up a dock and killed 80 people. That'll make the newspaper.
Yeah. So wait, are they like clamoring to like claim him as one of their native sons?
I think it depends who you ask, but like, I think at least like people writing the headlines are like, could have been this guy.
Only a Boston kid could bomb like that.
Yeah, pretty much. But there's some of it that goes the other way around too. So in St. Louis, a detective named John Agan, spelled like Reagan, but without the R, E-A-G-A-N.
I would say Egan.
Egan?
I would say Egan, probably. Yeah.
Okay.
There's a...
Johnald Agan.
Yeah.
Okay, John Egan. If I'm wrong, listeners, if you're mad about the pronunciation of Egan, you can tweet your vitriol at... well, hey, why don't you drop your...
Oh, yeah, it's a great
social
list.
Media handles.
Me, personally, I am on Twitter. I am at Hive Fleet Hodag. That is both a Warhammer and a Wisconsin folklore reference.
Okay, I was wondering about that.
Well, because Tyranid Hive Fleets in Warhammer are named after, like, mythical monsters, like Hive Fleet Leviathan, Hive Fleet Hydra. The Hodag is a local Wisconsin cryptid.
I remember that coming up, yeah. I was like, okay, I understand half the name now.
But anyway, yes. Egan, there's also a city in Minnesota called Egan that's spelled E-A-G-A-N. So that's why I'm going with Egan, Minnesota.
So in St. Louis, a detective named John Egan. Let's get everyone mad.
Yagan. Let's go with Yagan.
Yeah. The detective John Egan remembers, hey, didn't I help arrest a pretty shady guy about a decade ago and help him flee the state? Don't I still have his carte de visite? Doesn't it say Halifax, Nova Scotia on it? So he starts talking to the papers. And the Pinkertons catch wind of this. They send someone down to talk to Egan, who shows it to them. Not only does the likeness match, so does the signature to the handwriting they have on hand from the suicide note. And this is where things start to crystallize. The villain at the heart of the story had not just done a favor to himself by using all these aliases, but to me as well. Because it's allowed me to withhold the truth from you until now.
Oh no.
I've been calling this man William King Thomas because that's by and large the name he officially went with while he was in Europe. That's how he was known to the German police in their records. That's the name he used on his suicide notes. But this and a slew of other names spread across the book were all fake. Sometimes Thomas, but other times William King Thompson, or even Alexander King Thompson. Alternatively, George S. Thomas, Teodoro Viskov, W.J. Garcia. I saw it in some places, Garcia. And more we may not know about. The confusion over which part of which names was maybe true, or even what was a given name or a surname, was part of what led to so many red herrings. Rumors and or investigations followed various unrelated men in the United States, like William Henry Thompson, Henry Thomas, James Thomas, F.A. Alexander, Captain Alexander, and of course, Dynamite Johnson.
That's what they call me.
Which I'm stealing for my future porn career. There was even an attention directed towards another bearded insurance fraudster, an Englishman who used the alias Thompson. But none of this was close to his true identity. Now, I'd call that a white lie, because back at the beginning, it was true when I said this man shared a name with his somewhat famous uncle, initially adding Junior to make the distinction.
Mm-hmm.
This uncle was, as I said earlier, a successful politician, elected 3 times the mayor of Halifax, and later became the president of the Legislative Council of Nova Scotia. He was also, as previously mentioned, a very successful businessman. He at one point became the director of the Bank of Nova Scotia, for example, as well as an executive or founder of a whole host of other companies. but perhaps none more famous than the business that bore the name he shared with his Confederate abetting, locomotive swindling, terrorism pioneering nephew. We'll do I could finish my drink here. And that name was Alexander Keith.
Yay! It all connects. That is the Chekhov. That's Chekhov's beer. Yeah.
It is Chekhov's beer, yeah. So his uncle, Alexander Keith Sr., the proprietor of the brewery, did actually hearken to his Scottish heritage, not as a Thomas, but as a Keith. He claimed this ancestry of like Clan Keith, which had done like all of this fighting for like the Jacobite side. And he actually lifted. So like in the book, she says like, it's dubious that he could really claim this lineage. I mean, he did have the last name, but he lifted this red stag from their coat of arms to put on the beer labels.
Very cool. Keith, yeah. Keith is my middle name, actually.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can also claim your lineage.
Yeah, I'm going to claim some lineage here.
Here is Alexander Keith Sr. in all his like Freemason regalia. And in fairness to him, he died in 1873, so he didn't even get to see his horrible fail nephew.
It's like a big necklace, and it's like it looks like a breastplate, but it's over his dick. Like it's
yeah,
it's and he's got some looks like some big like I don't know what those are like greaves or something he's wearing.
Yeah, this also came up in our Don Cherry episodes, but like something that I think the U.S. sufficiently slept off that the rest of the colonial world, because you see this all across Canada, Australia, New Zealand. Did not is this like very British ass mayoral regalia.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think that's his mayor shit. It has nothing to do with the Freemasons. It's just like how mayors dress. At least the chain is for sure. I'm pretty sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So very embarrassing, very stupid. So once the Pinkertons had someone to connect, the dots fell into place. They matched the suicide notes left by William King Thomas, as he formerly styled himself in Germany, UK, to the signature of Alexander King Thompson, as he formerly styled himself in Missouri and Illinois. This latter moniker was similarly on the St. Louis marriage license that also bore the name of Cecilia Paris, strengthening the connection. It wasn't long before connections in the area were able to confirm that it was their A.K. Thompson who appeared in the German photographs, and others from Halifax were able to identify the same images as being their Alexander Keith Jr., or Sandy Keith, as he became known as he began to establish himself more independently. In the end, the Pinkertons managed to pin down anatomical evidence as well. The man who had mysteriously disappeared from North America and the man who'd mysteriously appeared in Europe both had an ambiguous forearm tattoo that could either be interpreted as an A or a K, as well as an identifying scar on his left hand, which he'd earned as a young man after a mishap at his first job bottling beer at his uncle's brewery.
So we have a design that could be read different ways. If they're upside down or right side up, we're back. This is from the Da Vinci Code or Angels and Demons or one of those. This is just like that.
It is like that thing that I can't remember the name of.
An ambigram, I think it's called.
Yes, it's an ambigram, yeah. So, satisfied, the Pinkertons billed the German police the modern equivalent of just under $19,000 and prepared for a long few decades of union busting. Up in Halifax, though, this revelation was not so satisfying, with one local paper publicly denouncing the investigation and declaring that their long-lost Alexander Keith was emphatically not the dynamite fiend. With that, the Keith family continued to assume a prominent and respectable position in the city, and everyone slowly forgot about the horrible tragedy that had happened a whole ocean away. Keith, so I'm going with his real name now, Keith would also be disavowed by his second home. The Intelligencer, a newspaper based in Edwardsville, Illinois, which is kind of like between St. Louis and Highland, was as inaccurate in their obituary as they were petty. Quote, born in Germany, raised and depraved in Brooklyn, partly reformed in St. Louis, mortally ruined again abroad. Exit, dynamite fiend. Raised and depraved in New York, baby!
Depraved in Brooklyn is just a great, I don't know, a memoir title or something.
Yeah.
Aw, Palouche's finally here.
Well, we got our cats eventually. We didn't get Momo, but we got lots of Toshi. In the aftermath of everything we've talked about, a few interesting things happened. For one thing, you may have been briefly concerned about the survivor of Keith's original target, the Deutschland, waiting to be picked up by his next target, the Moselle. Well, obviously, the good news now was they didn't get bombed on that day either. They were instead picked up by a ship called the Salier, S-A-L-I-E-R, which was filled with survivors from the Moselle. Interestingly, while the Deutschland survivors were each given 27 shillings in charitable donations, the Moselle survivors all got 13 pounds by the same mechanism. In today's terms, that's $250 versus $2,400 USD, more or less. In only the latter instance, Larrabee makes a point of saying that the shipping company didn't give them fuck all, although my interpretation is that all the company itself gave the first group was a train fare, and you could argue that the company had measurably less culpability in the bombing incident than the grounding incident.
Right.
Thankfully, both groups of survivors made it to New York safely, and the Salier promptly almost sank on its return trip.
There you go.
And speaking of restitution, what about the true victim of all this, the most wronged man in history, Luther Rice Smoot? After all, it was his persistence over his stolen money that kicked off Keith's flight to Europe to begin with. Well, when the detective he'd enlisted started telling the media about his daring adventure to pursue and arrest this dangerous man, Smoot was upset for three reasons. One, allegations of his blockade running were bad for his reputation. Two, any connection to the man now known as the Dynamite Fiend was bad for his reputation. And three, the idea that the other guy was the dashing, that being Detective John Egan, the idea that the other guy was the dashing hero of the story and not him was bad for his reputation.
Mm-hmm.
When a Pinkerton agent came to ask him questions, it went like this.
Smoot regaled him with the story of his grand pursuit of his nemesis, bragging about his friendship with William Tecumseh Sherman. He insisted on tarring John Egan's name, complaining that Egan had insisted on $1,000 up front before he would help Smoot. But Smoot did not tell the Pinkerton investigator the motivation behind his anger with Sandy Keith. The Norris locomotive engines. This he kept to himself, saying only that Keith had absconded with $25,000 of his money. Instead, Smoot cut the detective off before any embarrassing questions might arise, saying that he could say no more until he was certain that Keith was William King Thomas. In the end, he would never say another word about it.
Smoot's a fun guy. I kind of like the quick, like, reference to Sherman again comes in, because it kind of gives me this idea that, like, maybe he wasn't even as involved as he said. It's just this guy who's like, trust me, I'm friends with Sherman. Like,
I know him. He remembers me.
As far as the trains were concerned, Smoot never got his way. A year after he only got back 10 of his $25,000 from Keith at gunpoint, the government sold the engines for just over $11,000. Although he spent the next 9 years or so petitioning them for restitution, after all of it, he got nothing further.
So you're telling me that Smoot's pursuit of his loot bore no fruit?
Toot toot, goes the train. While the Pinkertons had done the bulk of the investigation, the German police themselves declared that, despite his crimes, Keith had not been the one to sink the city of Boston. There simply wasn't any real evidence to connect him to it, although that never stopped poor fact-checkers from suggesting he may have had a hand in the disaster 5 years before his bungled bombing of the Moselle. In a similar vein, it's easy to see how people worked backward to the idea that he'd sunk Patrick Martin's ship, two ships even, but sadly the much more sensible explanation remains... just did that. Finally, in the immediate wake of the explosion, a great deal was made about how this great new threat to travelers was looming. As one editorial went, quote, if most men, or many men, are capable of such plots, the sooner the earth explodes itself, the better, end quote.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can see the logic there.
Yeah, not a new idea. So when people are like, man, just we need a meteor to kill the earth. Like, we've been saying this since 1875. And you can kind of imagine that. It's like, oh, suddenly dynamite is in everyone's hands. They could blow up any, like, any train, any boat, any whatever. Like, you can see why you'd be scared. Like, it is sort of this mini 9/11 to also bring that reference back in.
Well, I can't believe that a weapon of death would ever be readily available for someone to buy. You know, just off the shelf, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Seems crazy that any society would allow that to happen.
Yeah. Good thing we don't do that anymore. And it's like, I kind of danced around it because I was like, oh, this is a spoiler. But that's why in the introduction, the author brings up the like 9/11. She's like, yeah, you can imagine the connection of like, you know, like there's this person who did this like terrorism on domestic travel or like on international travel. This is all fresh on everyone's minds in like 2001 or 2002. Where, like, I was just, like, so nervous getting on a plane to go to Germany to go to these archives.
It's like, turns out Muhammad Atta had, like, a super huge insurance policy taken out on that plane.
Well, no, he's the mark, obviously. Like, Bin Laden is the guy who's got the insurance policy.
The one who's got the insurance policy.
That'd be very funny if, like, Bin Laden did not believe in any of, like, the ideological, like, you know, like, fundamentalism or anything. He just had an insurance policy on the Twin Towers.
Yeah, it's like, my scam has been pulled off flawlessly.
Yeah. As you might guess, the fear of terrorists striking large numbers of people using the predominant form of international travel had some parties clamoring for new rules and restrictions. But in this case, ultimately, nothing was ever really put into place. So, that's the story of how one of history's greatest unknown fail sons scammed his way to the top and sort of invented terrorism. The reason I kind of went down the time bomb path was like, this is Wikipedia's box. They're like, first ever was the turtle, possibly didn't actually happen. Second one was this Confederate explosion in the Union like storehouse or in their port, an act of war. And then those ones I found on my own were like, yeah, a guy experimenting, he blew up derelict ships. This is the first time that a person kills civilians with a time bomb. And like, it's an incredibly obscure story, but he kind of like, he pioneered this in a way.
Yeah, it's like, it's possible I've heard shreds of this, but like, I just never knew anything about this story. It's crazy.
I didn't either. The reason I found out about it was we have a mug in my glasses in my kitchen. This is like Alexander Keith 211th birthday, and I'm like, why would you have a 211th birthday? Let me look up when he was born. I punched in Alexander Keith into Wikipedia, and it was like, do you want Alexander Keith Jr. the terrorist? And I was like, what the fuck is this?
Oh yeah, the pioneer of Canadian global terrorism.
Yeah, and that's how we ended up with this story, where it's like one person has written a book on it, no one talks about it. And again, part is because like the people in Nova Scotia were like, this didn't happen.
The great shame of Nova Scotia.
Yeah. The shame of Nova Scotia. Well, like I said at the beginning, like that was another trick. I was like, there's no Wikipedia article for William King Thomas. There is a Wikipedia article for Alexander Keith Jr., but it's like, it only cites the book and the New York Times review of the book. And yeah, it's like, it's just very little. I was surprised how little ink was spilled on a thing that was so innovative. And again, like, even if that thing from the turtle was true, that guy or like that situation invented a time bomb. Like, how is this not better documented?
And as you pointed out a lot earlier, but it's like all of that to ultimately make like not that much money.
To pay off one hat bill.
If my wife does not stop buying hats, half of Germany is going to be dead because I got to do this 40 more times.
Yeah. I mean, no one ever accused like people like you kind of really got into the beginning where you're like, these people can't stop. They just get more and more. Like, I kind of was a little accusatory of the author of like, well, you're reading a lot into his mental state, but like, this person's got to be some kind of sociopath. Like, you don't have any empathy. You just do whatever you feel like doing. And it doesn't matter if that kills 80 people or 200 people or 600 people. Like,
yeah,
whatever. And like, I have a bill to pay. I still feel like he could have gotten a better insurance policy on it, but.
Probably. Yes, this was such a cool story. Just all of the twists and turns of it is also very well set up by you. So. Very, very nicely put together.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, like the author opens the book by explaining who the brewer is and who his nephew is. And I'm like, no, this has to be hidden.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So she also does a little more extrapolating at the end, which I think is also kind of interesting. If you look at, you can even go to Wikipedia right now. You can look at like the history of time bombs. Once this happens, it's more common for people to use the time bombs. So one of the most notable ones that happens after is the 1880 attempt to assassinate Tsar Alexander II by Narendra Volia. And then over the next 5 years, you have this Fenian dynamite campaign. So like reporting at the time is like comparing it to the dynamite fiend. Exactly how directly they were inspired. You know, it's not like people wouldn't have come to the idea of a time bomb either way. But it's like, yeah, you could kind of draw a loose connection of like, he did kick this off, or like at least the invention of dynamite kicked this off. But yeah, it's at least worth wondering how much the Russian anarchists or how much the Fenians knew about him specifically.
I think Fenian dynamite sounds like a nickname for like an Irish American boxer in 1905.
Hell yeah. Now, we've talked a lot about apocryphal things, and nothing is more apocryphal than last words. But the circumstances around his death seemed fitting. As he lay waiting to die, he insisted to those around him, "I have had ill luck, that's all." Reportedly, his last words were, "I have been a thickhead. The fellows in New York are guilty." New York.
New York. Love the Mets.
After death, sources agree that his body was decapitated. There's another weird contention here. Larrabee says the coroner had official permission. The Antiquarian Horological Society claims that the decapitation was unauthorized and that his body was unceremoniously buried outside of the set. It seems like a thing somebody should straighten out. Like, was he allowed?
I like to imagine, like, the idea that, like, oh, he had permission to do this. I imagine, like, the doctors waiting there as he's expiring and, like, they, like, mark it on their top, oh, like, mark time of death, whatever. And then, like, camera pans over to, like, the coroner or whatever, who's just, like, got the knives ready. He's just like, can I do it? Can I do this one? Can I? Yeah. You said I could do it. You said I could do one today.
So this second source saying the action was unauthorized says his body was unceremoniously buried outside of the cemetery where 43 of his victims were placed in a mass grave. Regardless, we know his head was preserved in a jar before being donated to the Museum of Nature and Ethnology in Bremerhaven and in turn, the Crime Museum of the City of Bremen. Sources also differ on just what happened next, but it's clear that somewhere between 1944 and 1945, the head was destroyed in an attack by the Allies. Possibly simply that grenades were thrown into the building, but the much funnier version, the one I think we should all choose to believe, regardless if there's any evidence for it, is that a bomb strike broke the jar and dumped the head among the body parts of actual bombing victims, and it was disposed along with the rest of the viscera.
it finally got him in the end. Live by the bomb, die by the bomb, and have your corpse mutilated further by the bomb.
Yes, 100%. And I mean, like, so much of the story, it's like, there's limits to how much you can even know the truth, but it's like, at least pretty well documented. His head was preserved and then it got destroyed in World War II. So
that's actually one of those, like, on one of those secret Nazi gold TV shows, there'll be an episode where it's like, this is one of the secret Nazi treasures that they hid away somewhere as the head of Alexander Keith Jr.
Yeah. And most importantly, we're talking about somebody's head from the 19th century. So, you know, there's absolutely no way we can finish this off without some good old fashioned phrenology. So I mentioned the death mask that was being made by the owner of a German wax museum. We'll quote one last time from, this is the full title, "The Dynamite Fiend, the Chilling Tale of a Confederate Spy, Con Artist, and Mass Murderer."
A New York Herald reporter wrote, "From the mask, it is easy to perceive how Alexander, alias Thomas, shot himself in the head, the ball remaining under the left eye. The face of Thomas, bearing a prominent English physiognomy, is tolerably large. The features betray nothing indicative of deep villainy. They even express a certain mildness, marked with great energy, and the rounded forehead betokens intelligence. In an age steeped in the false science of race, it was popularly believed that Anglo-Saxons would not ordinarily be given to vicious crimes. The typical criminal type was a dark and swarthy foreign type, or, if white, had congenital abnormalities revealed in a Neanderthal forehead, sharp features, small eyes, pointed ears, a thrusting chin, a mangy beard, and a curled upper lip with visible teeth ready to bite."
There's another fascinating... Oh, hello. Hey, come here.
Did like H.P. Lovecraft write this?
Onyx is back out of her crate. Hi.
No.
Yeah, so... I'm glad you didn't say "and a quote" when the quote ends, because if you're listening, like, it's probably challenging if you're not paying attention to notice when, like, the quoted phrenology ends and when the author speaking begins. She's very quickly like, oh yes, fake science, and then she goes on with like just kind of repeating it. And this is the excerpt that I took. Okay, you're restless, you go. Oh buddy, so cute. Again, audio version missing out. So this is the excerpt I took. She goes on like that for like several more paragraphs. But we're done with this book, leaving us a single unresolved narrative loose end, one final maritime disaster. On July 26, 2020, a body was found in Lake Minden, Ontario. Local residents who came across the corpse next to their dock contacted the Ontario Provincial Police, who had been searching the lake and the area after 55-year-old Robert Smith had been reported missing to the Toronto Police Service a few days earlier, and his motorcycle had been located in a nearby parking lot. Reporting from the time only states that a post-mortem examination would be conducted, but the police did not suspect foul play, and I wasn't able to find any public follow-up. It's probably reasonable, based on circumstantial evidence, to infer that this was also a suicide. According to Global News, a source with the Toronto Police Service confirms Smith is the same individual who, in 2008, was sentenced to 20 months in prison and 3 years of probation after pleading guilty to possessing and distributing child pornography. Smith's arrest came following an undercover police investigation in which police seized up to 1,000 graphic and sexual images of boys and girls under age 12. Smith, an actor best known for his role in Alexander Keith's beer commercials as an obnoxious Scotsman who berated patrons, was arrested again in June.
Oh, well, ending it similar to how we started it.
Out of Keith's. Out of Keith's. The pride of Nova Scotia since 1820. Alexander Keith died for that beer, and you let the taps run dry. Everyone, rise up. We must go. Everyone, who's with me? Who's with me?
Bottle okay?
Oh, bottle, yes. Oh, crap.
I had forgotten about that part of the story.
Well, that was the intention, but yeah, it was fascinating how it came back around. I was really hoping that he had died in like the Great Lakes to really kind of, but he died in like a regular lake.
I thought you were going to have like a big twist where it was like, actually the body that they discovered was the body of Alexander Keith Jr. Da-da-da.
Nope, just Toronto actor Robert Smith, the pride of Toronto.
Oof. Also, I was going to say the part about how like, people with Anglo-Saxon physiognomy would not normally be given to vicious crime. It reminds me a bit of, are you familiar with Andre Chikatilo?
No.
He's like the, probably not, surely not the only one, but like he's like the famed or infamous Soviet serial killer. I think he was killing people in like the 70s or 80s.
Okay.
And it was something where a lot of the initial reporting, a lot of the investigations, it was a problem to investigate what little I know about the case, because there was this like refusal to accept that like serial killers are an American problem. Like that's not something that would happen in the Soviet Union. That's what Americans do. So it couldn't possibly happen here. So unless you have American physiognomy, maybe.
I imagine there's a bunch of tankies on Twitter being like, oh no. This was different. Like this was in the Soviet Union. Like he was actually working, if you look at it dialectically, he was advancing the causes of communism.
Mm-hmm.
And I should mention again, because it's been several parts, like we quoted from the Global News thing there, they use the term child pornography again. It's like
right,
a much better term to call it child sex abuse material, but because it's just like, it's more descriptive, more academic,
right.
But yeah, he found him in a lake. So probably some lesson learned at sea there.
Probably.
But I do have a palate cleanser.
All right.
We have one last requirement. Based on that first episode, we've been playing a game where we try to connect the main character of an episode to noted multimedia heartthrob Canadian Earth celebrity George Strombolopoulos. So it was easy to connect Don Cherry to George Strombolopoulos. We did a couple movie episodes, so easy to connect people in the film industry to George Strombolopoulos. I also managed to connect Tim Horton to George Strombolopoulos. So now we have Alexander Keith Jr.
Hmm.
Are you bringing him up?
Yeah, I have his Wikipedia up.
So let's see what we can pull off.
A lot here. Of awards here, it looks like. Let's see. Vegan, straight edge. Do we know anything about Keith's drinking or drug use habits?
Oh, I should be clear. I've solved this game.
Ah.
and I'm doing like, I'm connections between people.
Mm-hmm.
So Alexander Keith Jr. was a business associate of the man trying to reinvigorate the slave trade, Charles Augustus Lafayette Lamar. Lamar's second cousin was Lucius Quintus Cincinnatus Lamar II. This Lamar was appointed Secretary of the Interior by President Grover Cleveland. When Cleveland was the incumbent unsuccessfully running for his second term in 1888, to before he won again.
Mm-hmm.
A speech in support of his renomination at the party convention was delivered by a prominent Boston Democrat named Patrick Joseph Kennedy. If you follow American politics in 2024, then you may be familiar with his great-grandson, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
Oh, yeah.
But before he was a prominent anti-vax psycho, RFK Jr. was known more for his environmental activism, which was the topic of discussion in October of 2008 when he was interviewed on The Hour with George Stromboulopoulos.
Fine work.
I didn't think I could manage that, but I did. Thank God for the Kennedys is all we can say.
Oh, my God.
So that's the end of the document.
The other day, I finally heard RFK Jr.'s voice for the first time because he's one of those people I just kind of scroll past when he comes up.
Yeah.
And I finally listened to his voice, and man, that guy sounds like he is literally a corpse already.
No, he sounded like that in 2008.
Yeah.
But I it's some sort of medical thing. I don't know. I don't want to wade into it. But yeah, what you can still see that interview. I have a link to it. So, okay, you've now learned about one of the weirdest, most obscured stories I've come across. How you feeling?
That was really cool. I feel like I learned a lot. I feel like I exerted myself mentally, physically, emotionally. Yeah, it was a good way to spend a Saturday. Literally most of a Saturday.
Oh, well, I said 4 hours.
No, that was good. That was awesome. It's always a good time coming on here to talk to you. Got to talk about some shipwrecks. I learned a lot from this.
Me too. But I do need to learn how to make simpler shit.
Also, it is really fun to, it's always fun to do a podcast that is like a total surprise, like going into it totally blind, basically.
Yeah.
And I can, you know, be like a sort of an interactive member of the audience.
That was the hope. I hope people enjoy the surprise. I hope you didn't guess it too early.
No, I was guessing that you had me guessing the whole time. So this was awesome. So thank you for having me on. We will get you onto our show to talk about probably the HMS Speedy at some point here soon.
Oh, okay.
So don't Google that.
I will not.
Though you may be tempted.
Yeah. So do you want to quick plug your show one last time? This is when people are finally listening again.
One
yeah.
last plug for the road. My name is Tanner. I am from a podcast called Beyond the Breakers. We talk about shipwrecks, lost lessons learned from maritime disasters. We are on Patreon at patreon.com/beyondthebreakers. We put out episodes sort of weekly, sort of every 2 weeks. We put out up to 2 bonus episodes a month. I am on Twitter at HiveFleetHodag. We are on Twitter at Beyond_Breakers. Instagram at Beyond the Breakers Podcast. You can send us an email at BeyondTheBreakersPod@gmail.com if you want to send us a suggestion for an episode you'd like to hear us cover.
Wonderful. And you can find us at our link tree. It'll be in the description, but it's also linktr.ee/boredandunderpunches. No E in punches. Yes, I'm bad at SEO. And yeah, check out our audio versions, video versions. Check out our Discord. There will be pictures of these animals. We finally got Momo on camera. Mm-hmm. He may not have been the most into it, but yeah, je m'en caris. We did it, the 3-animal podcast.
Born Under Punches is a collaborative effort between me, Kelly Gomo, and a variety of contributors to create a variety of shows. If you want to support the project, you can do so by following us and our friends on our various socials. Check out the episode description for all the relevant links, especially this one. Patreon.com/BornUnderPunches. No E in punches. By supporting us on Patreon, you can enable this show to sustain itself and produce regular episodes. Join at the basic tier for expanded access to our Discord server, donate at an elevated level for monthly bonus content, or even fund us at the highest amount. And once a month, I will draw anything you ask me to on an index card. And hey, if money's an object, word of mouth goes a long, long way.
Blue, blue, what a pop! Oh, how she loves the Stanley Cup! Hockey man is what I am! Let's go! Listen to what I say. Play that game the Canadian way. Hockey man is what I am. Let's go!
Any sources used in the episode you just heard can also be found in the description. This content was primarily produced in Amiskwetsiwaskaik, the traditional territory of the Nahiwak, Nakota, Niitsitapi, Mikawe, Métis, and other nations. Also known as Edmonton, Alberta, in Western Treaty 6 territory. Thanks for listening, and happy trails to you.